We're supposed to have this panel at 2 o'clock, so I just want to get started now. I'll speak for about, 35 minutes, 40 minutes, and then we can have some questions or comments. Okay, are we set? Oh, you're David, right? Okay, I see you online, but not... Okay. What I want to do in this lecture is look at some of the main points in the Hirsch-Bamberger controversy, and then take note of some things that are not so commonly known, and follow the story after the death of Hirsch, because the issues continue to reverberate. As we mentioned this morning, there are two major aspects of Hirsch's philosophy, one being Ausstritt, the other being Torim Derech Eretz. It must be stated, however, that he only spoke about Ausstritt when he came back to Frankfurt. He was in Moravia, he comes back. Until then, we don't have evidence of an ideology focused on Ausstritt. But this shouldn't take away from the fact that this was a central aspect of his worldview. The situation in Germany was as follows. If you declared your religion as Jewish, you had to pay taxes to the Jewish community. And then these taxes would be used to support the hospital, would pay the salaries of the chazan, the rabbi, etc. This is the kahila structure. I don't know if you have it in Canada at all or if you ever had it. We don't have it in America. But in Europe, you had a kahila structure. Sounds very nice, right? The problems arise in the 19th century when reform becomes popular. In the cities, you now have both reform and Orthodox synagogues, and this creates a problem for Orthodox Jews because their tax money is then going to support reform institutions, and they don't want to support heretical institutions. This is actually not really a problem unless the community is overwhelmingly Orthodox, because if the community is split, then you could say that your money is going to the Orthodox institutions and the Reform money is going to the Reform institutions, or your money, and even if there's you're a little more than the Reform, you could say your money goes to the Reform Orthodox shul and the hospital. So unless you're the overwhelming majority, you can talk about the money, and they did do this in a way that your money doesn't actually support the Reform institutions. Now, in the case in Frankfurt, where the Orthodox were a minority, there wasn't any technical halachic problem with Orthodox money supporting Reform institutions because the Reform, there are many more of them giving money. There's another problem, though. Can an Orthodox Jew be in the same community with the Reform, with the non-Orthodox, since you are granting recognition to a heretical movement, that is, you're showing that you relate to them as an authentic form of Judaism? The fact that they have a seat at the table means that you are recognizing them. Now, the origins of this are in Frankfurt, where the Orthodox were having all sorts of problems. They weren't treated the way they would like to. They didn't get the money they want. The synagogue they wanted fixed up. The mikveh had been closed, that sort of thing. In such an environment, a group of Jews came together to create a separate community. They couldn't actually call it a community. They called it a society. And they continued to pay taxes to the larger community. That was the law. But they also brought in their own rabbi, Samson Raphael Hirsch, and supported their own synagogue. Hirsch comes to Frankfurt to lead the small group of Orthodox Jews who want to sacrifice for Torah Judaism, and you see they're sacrificing because they're paying two taxes, they're paying taxes and they're supporting this community, and they want to build a Torah society, a Torim Derech Eretz society in Germany. During his time in Frankfurt, Hirsch comes to the conclusion that the only way in modern times you can have a Torah society is to separate on a communal level from the non-Orthodox. Now, it's become almost a truism in Orthodox presentations of Hirsch that while he had a negative view of the Reform movement and Reform leaders, as with regard to the individual Reform Jews, he did not have a negative view. His negative outlook did not extend to the individual non-observant who were regarded as unwitting sinners, people who, due to their lack of education, were to be judged sympathetically. And it's not surprising that this is a standard view because Hirsch himself claims that everything I'm saying is only against organized heresy, not against individual heretics. In addition, contemporary orthodoxy is very much involved in outreach, and you can't do much outreach if actually you think it's okay to say that the Reform institutions and synagogues, they're terrible places, but you can't say that about the individual non-Orthodox Jews. You won't be very successful. I mean, basic to Orthodox outreach is that the non-observant is not judged negatively because the non-observant doesn't know any better. Yet Dr. Furziger, I don't know if he's here right now, in his book, which I saw you can purchase out there, he shows, quite skillfully, that there is actually a tension in Hirsch's writings on this point. Although, for the most part, Hirsch does keep the distinction between individuals and communal institutions, like reform institutions, there are times where this breaks down and you actually see strong negative comments about reform Jews as individuals, which shouldn't be surprising. What's surprising is the other way. If you look at the standard halachic texts that speak about reform Jews, they don't make this distinction. If you look at the Chasam Sofer, he doesn't distinguish between the rabbis and the individuals. They're all apikarsim, and we have to be away, get away from all of them. But you do see this tension in Hirsch's writings. The problem was that the law did not allow Hirsch to set up his own religious community and just pay taxes to that community. So he sets out to change the law. Now, in 1873, the parliament had permitted Christians to establish independent religious communities. So that gave him the confidence. This was an enlightened era. You had members of parliament who were enlightened, liberals, that he would also be able to push forth a measure that would allow Jews the same rights. And he succeeded in this. In 1876, the lawmakers became convinced that it violated freedom of conscience for the Orthodox to be forced in a community that didn't express their ideals. Now, this is quite ironic, because the Orthodox were able to win their case arguing for freedom of conscience, something which was basic to the modern liberal approach. And when I say liberal, I don't mean liberal like you have in Canada or even in America. I mean, conservative Republicans would be liberal in 19th century Frankfurt. Yet a few generations before, in the great dispute in Hamburg over the Hamburg Temple, the Orthodox, as they now began to be called, actually, they weren't even called that. We called them that. It was only a little bit later. But the Torah Jews appealed to the government to shut down the Reform temples. And it was the Reformers who were arguing based on freedom of conscience. And here, when the tables had been turned, Hirsch has to use the same argument that the Orthodox, to a man, rejected just two generations before, and they emerged victorious on that, although we must have to give Hirsch credit, because Hirsch explains that this isn't just for him a matter of convenience, that he is ideologically in favor of freedom of religion, and he does not believe in coercion. Whereas the other rabbis acted as if, unfortunately, we can no longer enforce orthodoxy, so therefore we have to go along. Hirsch explains, in modern times, you cannot coerce. And his grandson, Professor Mordechai Breuer, took this to argue that in the state of Israel, there should be no religious coercion, that we have to apply religious coercion. The state of Israel has been a disaster, and that we have to go back to the Hirschian approach, that we're not in the ghetto of Eastern Europe, that in modern times, you do not bring people to religion by forcing them to marry according to Jewish law if they don't want to, by forcing them not to drive on Shabbos, et cetera, that's not the way. We might talk about that later. So returning to the 1876 decision of Parliament, this was an incredible victory for Hirsch. He sees this as nothing less than providence. Providence giving them the opportunity to finally create a traditional community. And you can't squander it. He announces to his community that secession from the larger Gemeinde, the larger community, is an obligation. No different than any other Torah obligation. We have to keep kosher. We can't eat on Yom Kippur. You are not permitted to remain in a community when you have the permission to separate in a community with the non-observant groups. The problem he had was that most of the Orthodox, and this included many of his own, most of his own followers, his big backers, the people who supported his community, didn't buy the argument. Many of them also had a feeling of communal loyalty. They didn't want to leave. You know, this was the old community of Frankfurt. It's not like our communities. They had been there for generations, especially since this meant that they wouldn't be able to be buried in the communal cemetery. Now, for us, again, this is not such a big deal. But if you're in a kahila in which your grandparents and your great-grandparents and everyone has been buried there, you withdraw from that community, you can't be buried in the cemetery. We know that for many of them, that was a significant thing. So Hirsch had very loyal followers. They didn't go with him on this. But they continued paying taxes to the larger community and to his community at incredible financial sacrifice. And now that it was legal to leave the general community, they refused to do so. Hirsch was convinced, however, that no reputable Orthodox rabbi would be able to oppose him in this. He knew that Israel Hildesheimer in Berlin supported him, and he thought that if he got enough rabbis together, the members of the community, after all, if you're part of an Orthodox community, there's only so long you can go against what all the rabbis say. You know, if you can find one rabbi to agree with you, that's one thing, but if all the rabbis say you can't do it, he will emerge victorious. His supporters invited another great rabbi, Zelman Baer Bamberger, from Würzburg, to come to Frankfurt to look at the situation, and then, they assumed, to issue a ruling supporting Hirsch. Who was Bamberger? none other than the greatest Torah scholar in Germany, an old-time Rav, in that he didn't have the advanced secular educations. He was a great posek, a Talmudist, without question the leading halachic authority in Germany after the death of Jacob Ettlinger. So he comes to Frankfurt, and he meets with the pro-secession group, and then he meets with the anti-secession group, who were represented by an important scholar of his day. I don't think anyone else today knows him. His name was Moshe Mainz. We have a few of his writings. And he comes out of this meeting, and he declares, there is no obligation to separate from the community. The Reform have made certain concessions, and it is now permitted to remain there in one kehillah to continue paying the taxes. They made concessions about the synagogue and other things. And he sets forth a principle that as long as the Reform are willing to allow the Orthodox not to have to violate their conscience in any area, you can remain together in one community, as Jews always had. In fact, I actually think that subconsciously, a lot of the dispute here has to do with the intellectual makeup of the people. For example, Hirsch. Hirsch was very much a modern rabbi. He had instituted reforms with a small r. Just to give an instance, earlier in his career, he actually abolished Kol Nidre. He used to bring the mother of the bride into the sanctuary when he did a wedding. I mean, he had all sorts of things he did. For him, I believe, it was very important to show that his reforms were nothing like the reforms of the reformers. That he had, for Bamberger, no one's going to accuse Bamberger. He's an old-time rabbi. No one's going to think there's any connection between him and the reformers. For Bamberger to be in one community, to sit around with them, okay, no big deal. For Hirsch, because he is so similar to them in many ways in trying to bring Judaism up to date, he has to show in other ways he's very different than them. I mean, they refer to him as neo-Orthodox. You know, they wanted to show that he's also reforming. That, at least that's my read of it. Now, Bamberger's rejection of Hirsch causes an enormous dispute to break out, a great literary dispute, just like, which Orthodox are great at having. Hirsch and Bamberger really went in at it. You can see their writings. They were translated into English in the collected writings of Hirsch, both Bamberger and Hirsch. There's other pamphlets which haven't yet been translated, and there's a number of stuff in manuscript. In his reply to Bamberger, in addition to disputing him on substance, Hirsch makes an important point, which I think would resonate with all rabbis. He says that we have a principle that when one Rav rules on something, another Rav cannot interfere. Otherwise, we'd have chaos. Well, the Rav of a community says, this is the halacha, you can't have outside Rabbanim constantly coming in. Bamberger replies that, yes, that is true, but this only applies when both rabbis are equal. But when one rabbi is a greater Talmud Chacham, then it doesn't apply. And you see in Hirsch's reply that he was very hurt by this answer, but he knew, and Bamberger was telling him that I'm the Gadol of Germany, and I can do this. And Bamberger mocks Hirsch's Talmudic knowledge. He really speaks down to him. And Hirsch replies to him saying, you think you're so high and mighty speaking to me this way, etc., etc. And I'm not going to judge who's correct. Great Talmudic scholars have examined their arguments, and some say Bamberger got the better of it. Others say Hirsch got the better of it. Not surprisingly, the children and descendants of Bamberger, who were great Talmudic scholars, wrote responsa. They say Bamberger won, and Hirsch can say Hirsch won. But that was the argument. Now, in his reply to Bamberger, Hirsch throws in something which comes from left field, which apparently is totally irrelevant. He speaks about how wonderful his kehillah is and how it is a model of Torah im derech eretz, Torah and worldly civilization. And this is the only thing that can bring Orthodox success. He also states that you, Bamberger, are opposed to Torah im derech eretz. Now, it's true that Bamberger was not an adherent of Torah im derech eretz along the Hirschian model, but he was not an ignorant man. I mean, he was self-taught, but he was not a believer in Hirsch's idea of Torah im derech eretz. What possible relevance does this have in an argument over separatism? Why does Hirsch throw this stuff in, that you're an opponent of Torah im derech eretz, so that explains why you're opposed to us? As we say in Talmudic language, Ma inyan shmita eto har Sinai. What does his opposition to Torah im derech eretz have anything to do with Auschwitz? Well, Jacob Katz deals with this in his article on Hirsch. He points out that you have to read it very carefully. Hirsch speaks about that the younger generation, which was raised on Torah im derech eretz, they are the future of Orthodoxy. What this means is that the younger generation being raised on this approach, they understand the significance and importance of Torah im derech eretz. Only those who are raised in accordance with Torah im Derech Eretz principles, can see how vital it is to separate from the reformers. People like Bamberger are from the old generation. They're not sophisticated. They don't see that the world is changing. They think it's okay to remain together in one community with the reformers, and it's simply enough for the Orthodox to have autonomy. It's like the olden days when you had non-believers and yet from Jews, and they were all in one community. They don't sense that we're in a new era here. This is ideological heresy. This isn't just individuals who are non-observant. Those who are adherents of Torah im Derech Eretz, who have been educated in the proper Torah fashion, because the only proper Torah fashion in modern times is Torah im Derech Eretz, they are the ones who truly understand how toxic reform is, and that any connection to them is dangerous. And it's only because Bamberger's not sophisticated, he doesn't know Torah im Derech Eretz, that he thinks it's not going to affect Jews that they sit together with the reformers. On the contrary, it'll be a subtly toxic wearing away against Torah Judaism. So that explains why Torah im Derech Eretz and Austrit are fundamentally linked in Hirsch's approach. The two cannot be separated. Because if you are a real Torah im Derech Eretz Jew, you understand what it means to have a Torah civilization, then you know you can't be with the reformers together. It just makes perfect sense. Now, before we go any further, let me clear up a misconception. Many people write about Bamberger as if he was a philosophical opponent of Austrit, as if he was someone who believed in unity of all Jews. And that is not correct. There were other times where he did write that you should separate. The only thing he said is when the reform give the Orthodox what they want, there's no obligation to separate. He never even said that you don't have to if you don't want to. We do see ideological supporters of Austrit. The successor in the general community, the next rabbi, Mordechai Horvitz, Marcus Horvitz, he was an ideological supporter. He believed, as we'll see, that you should remain in one community. It's a positive. Bamberger doesn't say that. He does throw in his response to Hirsch that by staying in, there is an element of Kirov. We can bring them close. That's how I understand these following words. Quote, "We reject and detest the belief system of reform with all our hearts. But this should not break the ties of personal friendship that bind us. Rather, we should cherish the hope that sooner or later they will come to realize and acknowledge the truth, even as we do." But this is not really of overriding importance, because at other times he was willing to countenance separatism, and Hirsch would agree with all those statements also. In his mature years, Hirsch continuously spoke about how we have nothing against the individual reformers. The difference between Hirsch and Bamberger is that for Hirsch, separatism is a first resort. For Bamberger, it's a last resort. For Hirsch, when you finally get the ability to separate, it's a cause for rejoicing. For Bamberger, it's a cause for upsetness, that Hirsch would say, great, we have reached the stage that we can separate. For Hirsch, unfortunately, we've reached the stage where we have to separate. It was a different approach. As I said, much to Hirsch's disappointment, very few followed him in this. Contrast this with Torah im Derech Eretz, where certainly in the big cities, German Orthodoxy as a whole became adherents of Torah im Derech Eretz. The only exceptions would be in the small towns, perhaps you have old people living the old way. Only four communities in Germany became official separatist communities, even though Hirsch regarded this as a terrible sin. Separatism becomes popular not in Germany, in Hungary, where most Orthodox Jews are members of, quote, separatist communities. And then you have what they call the status quo and the neologue, but most Orthodox Jews join the separatist communities. Although Hirsch was the originator, really, in practice of separatism, it reaches its apex in Hungary. I don't even know if I should call him this the originator, because he's identified with it, but in Hungary it identified pretty much independently. There were no separate kahilot in Eastern Europe. Think of the most extreme types you think of in terms of right-wing Orthodoxy, people like the Brisker Rav. In Brisk, the Brisker Rav was elected by Bundists, by non-Orthodox. They served on one community. The rabbis of Eastern Europe, of Lithuania and Poland, they refused to have separate communities. That becomes very significant. And we'll get back to that in a minute. When Jews from the East came to Germany, be it Frankfurt or Berlin, they didn't join the separatist community. They didn't have any understanding, any appreciation of the separatism, why you need to do this. They didn't do this in Poland or Lithuania, why they need to do it in Germany. And in Frankfurt, the general community had great Torah scholars. Rav Menachem Kirschbaum, who was the dayan on the Beis Din, in the end, he was killed in the Holocaust, Who was greater than Rav Menachem Kirshbaum and many others? But of course, there was great machlokes from everything. Whatever the unified community did, the separatist community rejected. The Erev, of course. Don't we all know about Erevs? It couldn't be seen more clearly in the Erev. You put up, Rabbi Noble puts it up, and then continues throughout the 30s. The separatists refused to accept that. But not only that, the separatists refused to step foot in the Orthodox shul, the main Orthodox shul, where a great Torah scholar, Mordechai Horovitz, a great posek, a greater posek than Hirsch, I don't have any question about that, they regarded this as forbidden territory in Cherem. And Mordechai Breuer told me his whole life, not only did he never step foot in it, he never walked on the same street as that shul. And we're not talking about a Reform shul. We're talking about the main Orthodox shul. Horovitz, though, was an ideological opponent of separatism. Now, let me just, in the interest of time, let me bring it forward a little bit. The debate continued. Orthodox Judaism was split in Germany until World War II. But there were some new developments in the 20th century. There was a Rav in Mannheim, Yitzhak Una. And he led the battle against Austria. He thought that we've now reached the point that in Hirsch's day you had ideological reformers that we had to separate perhaps. But today, even the Reform rabbis, they're not ideological, they don't know any better. And now is the time to once again have one community. And he argued, based on the concept of Arevut, that we have responsibility for the Reform Jews. We can't just abandon them. We need to be in there to make sure that we can do what we can for them, give them kosher food, have involvement with them. And he argued halachically, not just ideologically, that this is a halachic obligation upon us not to abandon the non-Orthodox Jews. Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg weighed in on this issue. When Yitzhak Una in the 20s, he started a whole movement. It was called the Achdut Movement. They had a newspaper. Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was asked about this. And his seminary, the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, they stayed out of this dispute. They had rabbis from all sides. But as a private individual, he wrote an essay on the topic, and he said, to decide which approach is correct, communal unity or separatism, you need to either be a prophet or a future historian. A prophet will tell you what's going to be, and a future historian will look back. He says, today, we don't have either of them, because the historians obviously that'll be in years in the future, and therefore, there's no answer to this problem. But one of the most interesting approaches was by Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski. Who is Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski? No less than the leading Torah scholar in Europe. Many would say the Gadol Hador of his generation. He was asked about this question also around this time, in the early 1920s. The Reform had instituted some new statements, and some people thought that maybe now the Reform are even worse, so maybe we should revisit the issue. And Rav Chaim Moser sends an amazing letter. He says that he can't answer this question. Why can't Rav Chaim Moser answer this question? Rav Chaim Moser was the God of Odor. He could answer any question, right? He begins by saying, you are asking me to answer a question that the great Gedolim of Germany, Hirsch and Bamberger, battled over. Rav Chaim Moser says as follows, quote, the fundamental solution to this basic question is, in my opinion, not like all rulings in Isser V'Heter, like in Kashrus issues, and not like the most difficult questions of Aguna, whose roots are found in Shas and Poskim. And the respondent, that is the person who answers the question, has to examine the views of the Rishonim and the Achronim and decide in accordance with halachic rules. He says, no. How you answer this question has to do with what he calls hashkafa behira, a clear outlook. The question is, which approach is of more benefit to Judaism? He states that the dispute between Hirsch and Bamberger, although it was couched, at least from Hirsch's side, in halachic terminology, Bamberger just replied by showing that Hirsch's halachic arguments were meaningless in his eyes, but Hirsch argued halachically. Rav Chaim Moser says it's really not a halachic dispute. It's a hashkafic dispute. Which is better for Orthodox Judaism? And he says the only way you can answer this is to take someone who's living there, who understands the situation intimately, who's aware of all the future implications. Outsiders cannot answer a question like this. And he says this explains why, during the great dispute between Bamberger and Hirsch, in those days, they always would turn to Gedolim of the East. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, there's all sorts of questions that he answers from rabbis in Germany. How come no one ever turned to the rabbis in Germany? I mean, rabbis of Eastern Europe. And if they did turn to them, we don't have any answers. Why didn't they reply? And he says, quote, because this question is not decided based on Talmudic and halachic sources. the Gedolim of the East knew that this was not a question they could answer. I think for me, you have to see the brilliance of Rav Chaim Ozer. Today, rabbis like to decide for all over the world, every case. And here Rav Chaim Ozer is saying, I can't answer it. I'm not there on the spot. I don't know the implications. I don't know where it's going to lead. And he goes through both sides. Why the Hirshians think that you have to separate, why the other side thinks you need to be in the general community because we're going to have a kosher. If they separate, there won't be a kosher hospital. There won't be other. I mean, he goes through all of them and he says, it's not for us to decide in the East. It's only the people who know what the implications are and know what's going to be more positive can decide this. As I mentioned, this dispute was part of German Jewry to the end. Let me tell you how it played out in one other area, which I think will reverberate, I think, in many of your minds with contemporary communities. The Nazi leaders had banned Shechita without prior stunning of animals. And Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg came up with a solution that you could stun animals in a halachically acceptable way. And he wanted the other Rabbanim to examine this issue. The separatist leaders in Frankfurt, led by a man, Rav called Horowitz, the Unsdorfer Rav, he was opposed to even looking at what Weinberg said. He believed that we are not going to start making changes in our traditional way of doing Shlita. Well, why did Weinberg want to do this? Because he wasn't afraid of the Frum Jews, but the Jews who weren't so attached, who now keep kosher, if they can't get meat, kosher meat, they're not going to go vegetarian. They're not going to just eat chicken. They're going to eat treif meat. So the Sri Deish, Weinberg thought it was vital to see if we could find a heter for the community. The Rav of Frankfurt, the separatist's attitude was, we're not going to dilute our religious practices for those whose commitment to Judaism is not absolute. There's no one answer to this question. I mean, I see the Unsdorfer Rav's position, who's now the Rav of Frankfurt. Why should we change our religious practices because of those people who are not so frum and they'll start eating treif? But Weinberg's attitude was, we have a revos for everyone. We need to be responsible. It's no different than the dispute over day schools today. Some day schools bring in all Jewish children, and they see this as their goal, Kiruv, and think of all the people I know, including myself, who became religious because we grew up in one of these schools where they accepted all people. On the other hand, there's many schools that don't accept you unless you come from a Shomer Shabbos home. And they're fully aware that we will not get many children that we could, but they look at it, they say, but this will then have a negative effect because then our children will not grow up in a pure environment. They're going to grow up and they'll be exposed to other things. And so you see, there's both sides, you can make a case. Obviously, each of us will have our own position on it, but that's the exact argument how it developed into the 20th century between the separatists and the unified community. It wasn't a case anymore of separating. No one in the unified community is going to separate. It's a question is, when you decide Jewish shul on Jewish policy, are we focused on our small group of believers, our strong Jews, or do we have this feeling of arevut for the larger community? And of course, as we'll see, this breaks down today as well. I don't have time to go into it now, but those who read my book will know that the separatist leaders, led by the Frankfurt always, but also with Berlin, they even sent this amazing letter to Hitler, in which they went so far as to separate themselves from the rest of the Jewish community in dealing with Hitler, which really goes too far, I believe. Now, while Auschwitz began in Germany, after the war, it reaches the United States. We're not talking about technical Auschwitz, because there's no Kehillot in the United States, but the ideology of Auschwitz. In Israel, Auschwitz technically never took over for the simple reason that you have to pay taxes. You're in this state. It doesn't make any sense to separate. But even the ideology of Auschwitz, which was advocated by many, Rav Kook, of course, was very opposed, as we spoke to it before. Rav Kook, as I mentioned, he saw this as nothing less than a Maisa Amalek to separate the Jewish people. I think that Rav Kook would have come to this decision on his own, but he was also influenced by his teacher, the Netziv of Volozhin. When he was asked about a separatist group in Galicia, he said that to separate the Jewish community is sharper than sticking daggers in your heart. He elaborates that when we deal internally with other Jews, we fight about Shabbos and Kashrus and all that, but when we deal with the non-Jews, we have to face them as an independent front. And I actually think this is what the Aguda is regarded as the quintessential separatist type organization. When they deal with the U.S. government, they actually do go together with the reform groups. They really follow the Netziv in that respect, although in other areas, like they refuse to be involved in the March on Washington and everything. So in that sense, they are separatists. But on the level of the leadership, they don't go the whole separatist route, and they do go together with the reform and et cetera. Let me talk about America a bit. how it developed, and I think probably in Canada it's similar. Before World War II, and we'll conclude with this, before World War II, you had old-fashioned rabbis, East European rabbis, and you also had more modern rabbis, those educated by yeshiva colleges, rabbinical school. The old-fashioned rabbis had Yiddish-speaking communities. They were never integrated on the American scene. They didn't have any really organized cooperation with the non-Orthodox. They were in their own world. They would get together if, for example, a politician was coming to town and the Jews wanted to greet him. I told the Rav, I was in Rav Soloveitchik's kollel one summer, and I told him, this was 1984, at the Republican National Convention, Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, some of you probably know the name, he's very involved in right-wing politics and all, he was asked to give the opening benediction at the Republican National Convention, and he did. And I told this to Rav Soloveitchik, and he was very impressed and very excited, and he started recounting how when he first came to America, whenever a politician would come to town, the European rabbanim, they couldn't speak English, so they'd have to send the Reform rabbi out to represent them. And he thought this was a great thing, that an Orthodox rabbi, and now we take it for granted, of course, but he thought this was a great thing. There were some examples of East European rabbis having organizational ties with the non-Orthodox. Very unusual, though. One is, anyone from New Jersey, you might know the name Naftali Tzvi Rief. He was the great-grandson of the Netziv. That's why his name, Naftali Tzvi. He was the Rav in Camden, New Jersey. He was, with a long flowing beard and everything, he was on the interdenominational board of rabbis. In my town of Scranton, there was an old Lithuanian Talmud Chacham, Rav Guterman. He was Rav for 50 years. He was on the interdenominational board of rabbis of the Federation, whatever they had. And the current Rav, who's very much a Haredi Rav, was asked about this. Well, if Rav Guterman, who everyone, at least the old-time generation, they hold him in awe, they revere him. They asked Rabbi Fine, if you can confirm this with your brother, they asked him, if Rav Guterman was on it, why can't you be on it? And Rabbi Fine said, now this might strike you as a cynical answer, but I think there's probably a lot of truth. He said, in those days, Orthodoxy was weak. So we had to be together with them. Now we're strong, and we don't need to be together with them. And I believe that's probably the case with people like Rav Guterman, although for many Orthodox rabbis, it was ideological. Remember, the mostly American-born and educated rabbis who were the ones who were on these boards, run by Federation. Their synagogues were members of the Synagogue Council of America. The OU and the RCA were part of this. And it made perfect sense during the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. No one thought that it was problematic because the Orthodox were not being asked to compromise their lifestyle in any way. These people all came from Eastern Europe. I mean, they knew what went on in Eastern Europe. The only reason East European rabbanim weren't involved is because they were not really part of the American scene. No one ever said that there was a halachic problem. How is this any different than sitting in Vilna on the board with the Bundists and the atheists and the Zionists? That's just the way Jews did it. The idea that Orthodox rabbis were legitimizing non-Orthodox rabbis by being together with them on a board, or that the Orthodox synagogues were legitimizing the conservative synagogues, that was not an issue. And when World War II came, the Orthodox rabbi sat with the Reform and the Conservative, and they produced prayer books and other things together. There was the Jewish Welfare Board. They produced all the things necessary for the soldiers. This approach continued after World War II, and the 1950s were really the heyday of the liberal modern Orthodox rabbinate, an era when figures such as Emanuel Rachman, Joseph Lookstein, soon Walter Wurzburger, men like that, they were really in the forefront of interdenominational cooperation, involvement, etc. Everything changes in 1956. And if you believe the story as told, it came about somewhat haphazardly. Here is the story, the famous story. There was a man, Mordechai Feuerstein. He later becomes head of the OU. I don't know, he's very ill now, so I can't ask him to confirm the story. I don't know if he was head of the OU at the time. His brother, you might not know Mordechai, but Aaron Feuerstein is the one, the Mills, Molden Mills. So I'm sure many of you heard the story. The mill burnt down. He continued paying his workers. And it made a huge Kiddush Hashem. No one talks about the fact that then the mill goes out of business. And had he fired some workers, maybe, instead of paying them all, he could have maybe kept it alive. But it was one of the biggest Kiddush Hashems for the Jewish world. And he continued paying these workers. So Mordechai Feuerstein was a big follower of Soloveitchik. He was in Boston. But he's at a wedding, and Rav Aaron Cutler is there. And he figures, if the Rav's not here, he's going to ask Rav Aaron Cutler, because it had been bothering him, these interdenominational boards. So he goes up to Rav Aaron Cutler, and he asks him at the wedding the question, is it permissible for the Orthodox to have organizational ties, either rabbinic or lay, because there was also lay ties. The OU was involved with the United Synagogue, etc., of the conservatives, with the non-Orthodox. Rivaron's answer was an unequivocal no. And when Rivaron, if you know a bit about Rivaron, he was a very active person. He didn't sit back. The fact that he was asked this, it must have got this idea in his head that there's an issue here, and he goes about organizing a proclamation that appears shortly after that, signed by the great Rosh Yeshiva in America, including two from Ritz, Rav David Lifshitz and Rav Mendel Zaks. Mendel Zaks was, it's called the Bochein. He wasn't a Rosh Yeshiva, but he was someone involved in the learning at YU. He was the son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim. And Rav David Lifshitz was very accepted in the Lithuanian Torah world. This proclamation, which has a heading, Psak Din, they're not giving their opinion, they're saying this is the halacha, states that it is absolutely forbidden to be a member of the New York Board of Rabbis or any, because we're talking primarily in New York, but and any other interdenominational board of rabbis anywhere. And it is also forbidden to be a member of an organization of like Synagogue Council of America where synagogues representing the non-Orthodox are involved. There's nothing wrong with being a member of the UJA or non-Orthodox Jews or anything, but you can't be involved in anything in which organized groups of the non-Orthodox. This is 1956. This is the beginning of Das Torah in America. Because remember, it's Psak Din, and they're not giving any reasons, any justification halachically, but this is the halacha. The Rav Soloveitchik, refused to sign. In fact, Rav Moshe Feinstein famously said that we have a klal, we have a principle in Talmud, that shtika koda adamya, that when someone doesn't protest, that it means he agrees. Rav Moshe Feinstein says, but I think in this case, my cousin, Rav Yosha Ber, shtika is not agreement, that the fact that he's quiet means he doesn't agree. And it was true. Rav Soloveitchik told, although he would not publicly say this, he told all the rabbis and he told the RCA that they should not feel bound. He didn't say that you should oppose it. If you want to go with it, fine. But he says you have no reason to feel bound by this. It is not halacha. And his students and the RCA and the OU continue to be involved in these organizations. The Synagogue Council of America only closed in 1994. Then the Orthodox really was very much against it. It is almost impossible today, very rare, to find any Orthodox rabbis, even graduates of YU, who are on these interdenominational boards. You do have some. Chovvei Torah, which now produces rabbis, they're very much into this. But it really became very difficult. It was the old-time rabbis. The young rabbis wouldn't do it. They either didn't appreciate it. They didn't see the value. Their rebbes, like Rav Schechter and others, were against it. And they didn't feel, many of them argued, if you ask Rav Schechter, he'll tell you, in those days it was necessary. Today, it's not necessary. Not that the Rav is wrong. He would never say that. Rav Aaron would say the Rav is wrong. Rav Schechter would say the Rav was speaking for his time, and not just Rav Schechter. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik himself said that if my brother was alive today, he said this before he passed away, if my brother was alive today, he too would oppose the Synagogue Council and all these things. But the Rav's position, as he explains it, is different than what Rav Aaron Soloveitchik explains it. The Rav gave an interview in 1956, and he says that Jews have to, and this is really from the Netziv, he's a descendant of the Netziv, that there's a distinction between klapei chutz and klapei pnim, how we relate to the goyim and how we relate internally. This is what the Rav says, quote, in the crematoria, the ashes of the pious and those filled with praiseworthy deeds mingled with the ashes of the radicals and freethinkers. We must jointly fight against the enemy who does not recognize the difference between one who worships and one who does not. The entire interview was found in the book they're selling outside of Rabbi Soloveitchik's letters. He says that when we deal with the goyim, when we relate to them, we have to be together because they don't recognize any difference. Internally, we fight. The point of these organizations, supposedly, were to bring benefit to Jews as a whole, vis-a-vis the non-Jewish world, vis-a-vis economic issues, etc. And Rav Soloveitchik thought that this could be very positive. It's a rejection of the Hirshian approach. Now, as everyone is aware, I'm pretty sure, the times have changed. It is very difficult to find Orthodox rabbis who agree to participate in these sorts of groups. I'm assuming Toronto, things are pretty similar. And it's not only the rabbis who've been affected. The issue of Orthodox involvement with Federation is also directly tied in with the Ausstadt question. And the further to the right you go on the spectrum of Orthodoxy, the less involvement you will find. And for many, there is complete avoidance of any organizations which are not, absolutely Orthodox, which follow Orthodox principles. from its beginnings in Germany, where most Orthodox Jews rejected the philosophy of Austerlitz, the ideology has grown and has never been more successful than it is today. While Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg said that it would have to be left to the historians and the prophets to determine if Austerlitz or unity is the best approach, I don't think we need either to tell us which approach has today conquered the Orthodox world. Thank you very much. Okay. I can see we have 10 minutes for some comments or questions, if anyone has. Okay. Nothing? Okay, well then we will be picking up in 10 more minutes over here for the panel discussion.